Hello, everybody,
Love
and welcome.
Talk Radio.
You're listening to the Leadership Focus, an internet radio show geared to everyday leadership, both at work and throughout your life. Each week, we present you with new ideas, interesting guests, and actionable strategies to help you be an incredible leader with a more balanced life. I'm your host, Lisa Pasbjorg, Executive Coach and CEO of Focus Coaching, a leadership coaching and training firm based in Ann Arbor, Michigan. Tonight, our topic is Women in Leadership, a different take on leadership today with Margaret Heffernan. And tonight our guest is Margaret Heffernan. Dr. Heffernan is an entrepreneur, chief executive, and author. She has bought, run, and sold 5 businesses and has been named one of the Internet's top 100 by Silicon Alley Reporter, one of the top 25 by Streaming Media Magazine, and one of the top 100 media executives by The Hollywood Report. Currently maintaining a home in both the UK and the US, Heffernan has published 3 books and writes for the Huffington Post, BNet, and Real Business. She's a visiting professor at Simmons College in Boston, an executive in residence at Babson College, and holds an honorary doctorate from the University of Bath. She sits on the council of the Royal Academy of Dramatic Art in the UK, as well as on the board of several private companies. We are thrilled to have her here tonight to share some of her incredible wisdom and knowledge, and as the first guest on our Women in Leadership series. Welcome, Margaret.
Thank you very much. It's great to be here.
Yeah, it's great to have you here. Margaret, you are quite the Renaissance woman. I did a really abbreviated version of your bio. Can you tell me how you started out in your career and how you your journey went along to
sure.
the career end?
Sure. Well, I think I started out like certainly many people and definitely very, very many women thought, which is I really hadn't got a clue what I wanted to do. I think I made a number of good decisions by accident, so to speak. So, you know, I went to an excellent university. But I, you know, I did a liberal arts degree because that's what I loved, but I really had no idea where it would go, and I had no real plan. And so when I left university, I, you know, had to pay the rent, so I went to work for the BBC as a secretary and really liked the environment, really liked the work, and climbed my way up through that institution. Now, I have to say, looking back, I think that was a phenomenally stupid thing to do. With the qualifications I had, I could have started very much higher up the organization. But I think it's a very typical mistake that women make, which is we don't take ourselves quite seriously enough. And we probably, I mean, I would say of all the hundreds, if not thousands of women I've interviewed, we constantly underestimate our own value. And I would say I absolutely did that at the beginning of my career. Having said that, you know, I've put myself in good places. Cambridge University was a good place to be. The BBC was a good place to be. And if I take any learning away from that, it's that even if you don't know what you want to do, to be around smart, creative people in any capacity really is probably a good career move. But after that, really what I did is, you know, what so many people do. I worked my socks off. I got well rewarded for it. And I gradually started to focus in on what were the things I really loved doing and what were my strengths. Then I really reached a point in the broadcasting world where I was more interested in the business side than the artistic side. And so eventually I left the BBC and ran my first company, which represented the interests of independent film and television producers. And really having entered the business world at that stage, pretty much never looked back. I say pretty much because I do still write plays, which the BBC produces. But really the bulk of my career since then has been focused on creating, running, buying, and selling and advising businesses, primarily in the media space, but not exclusively, because I've been very, very involved in the development of new technologies. So that, in a sort of nutshell, is a very, you know, a very succinct description of a very, very winding and improvised path.
Yeah, yeah. I think you're absolutely right. You know, as a coach, I see it so often working with women, really talented, really capable women who I hear aiming low, you know, going for something that they know they can do. And I'm often in a role of challenging them, essentially, to do something that's a little riskier and reminding them.
Well, I think that's right. And I think, I mean, I remember I did some work for one of the big investment banks a couple of years ago, and I think I was the first outside speaker they'd ever invited to their partners meeting. And after doing that engagement, I went on to talk to their women's network. And I spent about half a day with them. And I was shocked by two things. The first thing I was shocked by was how quickly women in that group were moved to tears. In other words, it struck me that their misery was only barely suppressed. And the other thing that really struck me was that the biggest problem they had was they had absolutely no idea how good they were. Nothing in the institution told them how good they were. Nothing in the culture told them how good they were. They clearly weren't involved with people who were telling them how good they were. And, you know, they were just being crushed, basically. And it was a very heartrending thing to watch. But I think, although I would say investment banks are uniquely difficult places for women to work, I would say in general, most of the women I've encountered struggle to feel comfortable with their own confidence. That if they're so anxious about appearing brash or overreaching, that they're overly modest and underreaching.
Yeah. And that whole concept of the imposter syndrome was written about women.
Yeah.
Who, you know, they get promoted and move up, and then they say, I can't do this. What was I thinking?
I've
snowed them all. I remember personally, and I've shared this story with a couple of clients when it was appropriate, that I got a big role in an international, as the president and CEO of an international relief, medical relief organization. And it was a big leap for me. I'd run other nonprofits, but this was international. It was much bigger. It was a big leap in salary. It was a big leap in responsibilities for me. And I was interviewed. You know, I was brought in and I was compared with other candidates, and I went through all these, you know, hoops and tests and all kinds of things. I was interviewed by the board of directors, who were all old white guys, were in very high positions, very, very high positions, and they all voted unanimously to select me. And I was thrilled, and then I came home and went, what have I done?
Yeah.
And I had to literally say to myself, you know, they're not all stupid. They must know something
I don't.
Yes.
No, I think that's very interesting. And it's something, I mean, I think women do really struggle with it no matter how high up the organization they are, no matter how many achievements they have under their belt. And I don't know why it is. I mean, I know there are a lot of theories out there, none of which has ever particularly convinced me. But I think really the best thing to do is to recognize that this is very common, that it isn't personal, and that and we need to just kind of put it behind us and move on. I mean, I'm very struck. My latest book is, you know, not about women. It's a book of sort of big ideas about business. And one of the people who interviewed me when I was, you know, when I've been promoting the book, said to me, you know, this is a book of very big ideas. And I said, yes. And she said, but you're quite small. And I thought it was a very curious comment. But I think what she was trying to get at was, if you think of the business books out there of big ideas, they're all written by men. Absolutely every single one of them. Women are allowed to write about women in business, but not about business as business. And I think, you know, I think really the only way to get over this is just kind of, you know, kind of clench your fists and jump in. Because as long as we stand on the edge of the pool, you know, we're never really going to get into the swim of things.
Right. Well, I want you to know that all my questions are about business. They're not about women in business.
Right.
Because
but,
I really think that,
I mean, I think you're right about the imposter syndrome, and I think it makes us sort of loath to enter the big debates about business. But I think women have a tremendous contribution to make, and goodness knows we need some fresh thinking.
We do. And women have big ideas as well.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right.
Yeah. So, you know, your shift, going back a little bit, your shift from the BBC and the arts, and I know that you're, you know, on the Academy of Dramatic Arts still and you're
mm-hmm.
writing plays. That's a really big shift. Was there something that happened in your life that made you decide to go the business route, which is, of course, not the more typical route as well?
Well, I think... I don't think there was any sort of seminal moment. I think there were a couple of things. One is I was working in television, which is a very, very, very visual medium. And I didn't think then, and I still don't think, that I'm the world's most visual person. I'm more of a verbal person. And I felt that although I was good at what I did, the very, very best people were more visual than I was. And I thought, well, those are the people who should be doing this stuff. To be honest, of course, at the time, I completely underestimated the value of other things that I brought to the table, including things like delivering my programs on time and on budget, which I kind of took for granted and only much later discovered most people didn't manage. So I think it was partly I didn't think I was the most visually brilliant of all of the creative people in the BBC. But I also think that I felt that I had more to learn, more capacity for stretch in going into the business side of things. And I also felt that the business side of things would take me more places, that it was a talent that was more convertible to other things. And I've always been very, very reluctant to tie my fate to any single institution. Partly because I've seen people do that and become very dependent on their employer. And I've felt very passionately, partly because I have a great love of autonomy, that I didn't want to become dependent on any single employer. I wanted talents that I could take anywhere. And I felt that the business part of television was a more portable skill. Mm-hmm. And in that, I turned out to be absolutely right, you know, that it took me from television to business, from business into multimedia, from multimedia into software technology and the internet. So I think that was a good call. But it was very driven by not wanting to be dependent on my employer.
Yeah. And I've seen so much of that. You know, people will tell me that they'll come to me and they'll tell me that they hate their job. You know, they really, really don't like it. And they just, you know, dread going to it every day and don't feel energized by it. And I'll say, well, why are you still there? And they'll say, well, it's only 7 more years till retirement.
Yeah.
And I'm going to walk in there for 7 days a week or 5 days a week for 7 years and hate it.
Yeah,
so
now
I
hear this. And you
know,
people saying, oh, well, you know, my pension's tied up in it and all this sort of thing. And you know, you also see people investing in their employees, in their employers, you know, investing their loyalty and their time and attention with a degree of loyalty that is rarely repaid.
Right.
And, you know, and they hope against all the evidence that if they work hard and are loyal and diligent and so on, that they will be looked after. And then, of course, they are absolutely crushed when that turns out not to be the case.
Right.
And I think I've always felt in my career that, you know, I always was diligent and loyal because that's my nature. But that didn't mean that I would be unaware of the outside world or unprepared to move. And I don't think that's disloyal. I think you also have to be loyal to yourself. So the other thing I would say is, you know, when I look back on my career and think, you know, what were the decisions that I took that were transformative as far as my career or my life are concerned, the most important ones were always the biggest risks. And so, especially when I'm talking to you know, my MBA students, for example, I try to make the point that, you know, that the safe career may be an attractive goal, and it may be absolutely appropriate for some people, but if you want an exciting career, that is going to involve risk. And you have to think about, A, what your tolerance for risk is, but you also have to think about how do you mitigate that risk. So to the degree that you do not encumber yourself with debt, for example, it's much easier to take risks. To the degree that you gradually create savings for yourself so that you can afford to take risks, you'll have a lot more freedom in the choices that you make. And it bothers me and worries me that we see so many people encumbered with student debt and now mortgage debt, which means that they feel well and truly stuck quite often in jobs that they would like to leave but feel that they daren't.
Right, right. You're absolutely true. Those kinds of things free you up.
You always need your storming off in a huff money. Mm-hmm. Because I've discovered this fantastic thing, which is if you have your storming off in a huff money for the moment where you feel there's really going to be a showdown or you're asked to do something you don't want to do or the business is going in a direction you don't like, if you have the freedom to say no, you almost never have to. It's as if everybody knows you're serious.
Right.
But if you're clinging on for dear life, everybody knows you're vulnerable.
Mm-hmm. And you send out those messages.
Yeah.
So this is a little bit of a segue, but I'm really curious, and I want to ask you this question. I was reading that you were recently featured on the television show, The Secret Millionaire.
Oh, yeah.
And I wanted you to... tell us a little bit about that, and how does that fit in with who you are?
Well, the program was initially created in the UK, and I did it here in the UK.
I didn't know that.
And I did it really because I thought it was a great opportunity to meet people and see things I would have no other chance to meet and to see. And to that extent, I was very glad I did it. It taught me a lot, and it was a very valuable experience. I didn't especially love being on television, and I didn't particularly like the process, which, of course, I'm very familiar with, but I thought the process of making the program was intensely boring. But what it did allow me to do was to visit and get to know a community very different from any that I have known before. And it taught me, I guess, two things. One was the extraordinary power of volunteering, because the two organizations I ended up giving money to are volunteer organizations, run by a woman who started it purely off her own bat because there was a problem and they saw a solution. And I was just immensely impressed by what they'd done and the initiative involved. And one of the things that has really rested with me is that both of these women, didn't have college degrees, weren't educated, and I would bet, my last dollar, none of them would ever be hired in a managerial position. And yet their management strengths were formidable. Their ability to create something out of nothing, their ability to lead a very disparate group of volunteers was sensational. And it truly taught me the degree to which we don't really know what we're looking for when we hire people. So that was a very important kind of learning experience for me. And the other thing I felt was, like all other, reasonably comfortably off mothers, I'm always talking about, how busy I am and so on. But I can find time to volunteer. And I know so many mothers, who agonize about, their kids in school and hockey and football and clothes and exams and music and so on. And they have more free time than most people on earth. And they don't volunteer. And it really made me think about how I spend my time. And so since doing the program, I continue to volunteer. And because my time is very erratic, I only do it over the Christmas holidays because I know that's when I'm going to be home. I know there are a couple of local organizations that need extra help then, and I know that it's time that I can commit and live up to and not let people down. But I did come from out of the experience with an absolute passionate belief that everybody can find the time to do this, and it's fantastic management training, and really there's no reason why not.
Interesting. Interesting. Yeah, I've worked
at. And, of course, you know, every busy mother in the world will hate me for saying that. But, well, you know, sometimes going to the gym or, you know, having a manicure, it really just, it just doesn't quite cut it for me.
Well, and there's role modeling with your kids, too, about what.
That's absolutely right. That's absolutely right. And sometimes, you know, sometimes they aren't the most important thing. And for them to think constantly that they are is a profoundly wrong message. And sometimes there are very much more important issues than their temporary needs.
So I want to take us back to the business world and tell us about what your prime focus is now. I know that you've just kicked off this book. What are you most interested, what are you most passionate about, what are you trying to move forward now?
Well, I think the thing I'm most passionate about at the moment, because it's very much been kicked off by the new book, is the degree to which most people, most employees, don't feel equipped to manage conflict in organizations. That if they're asked to do something that they think is wrong, or if there's something not being talked about in a company that needs to be talked about, or if they see a coworker who they think is incompetent or unsafe or dishonest, they seem to have absolutely no idea what to do with that information. They seem to believe that they have two choices: speak up and lose your job, or shut up. And I believe quite passionately that they're wrong about that. I think there is a vast range of options. But it alarms me considerably that they don't see them. And so I've been doing a lot of work with my MBA students, with some networking groups and so on, looking at how, when you see something that makes you uncomfortable at work, how do you surface it in a way that doesn't imperil your position but is also heard? And the reason I'm so passionate about this is that I know as a chief executive that all your information that I need exists in the company somewhere. The challenge is surfacing it. The challenge is creating a culture in which the information can be articulated. And as a chief executive, I absolutely always depended on people being prepared to tell me the truth. And if they hadn't been prepared to tell me the truth, I couldn't have done my job effectively. So it worries me like mad that we seem to have a very large cohort of employees who don't feel that they can do this. And so that's really very much the focus of a lot of my work at the moment, because if employees don't speak up, if there isn't honest and free debate within a company, then the management is flying blind and will make, can make, catastrophic mistakes.
Yeah, that's, you know, that's a fascinating topic. And I think about, I do a lot of work with culture in organizations, and one of the things I'm always working on is getting the information flowing in both directions, not just top down, but bottom up.
Yeah.
And it's safe to do that. And of course, some of how it can be safe is if you're skilled in how you articulate it.
Right.
And then, you know, it's always good to have storming off in a huff money too, just in case.
Absolutely.
But
it really, really bugs me
that,
you know, hundreds, thousands of people who write to me don't feel they have a choice. They have no idea how to manage these conflicts. And that's, it's frustrating for them. And it's very dangerous for the businesses because it means, A, that the leaders don't know what's going on, and B, that they're the leaders are managing a workforce that's becoming increasingly cynical. And that's a very bad place to be.
Yeah, and of
course, it may very often happen that the leaders want to know what's happening, that the employees actually wouldn't risk their jobs. But as long as they believe that they will, then they'll keep silent. And that silence is a gigantic and, I think, wildly underestimated business risk. And, of course, now that we have an economic environment that makes people nervous anyway, I think it's probably worse than ever.
Yeah, I'm thinking about when I had bunches of people reporting to me and they'd come to me with something that was uncomfortable or sticky. I would frequently say to them, of course, I would always say thank you and I appreciate you coming to me, but I'd also say, you know, I pay you to think. I pay you to tell me things that I need to know.
Yes.
It's very important that you do that.
So
that they knew that they'd done the right thing, you know, that...
Well, I think that's right, but I think all of us who feel that way still underestimate the degree to which people don't believe us.
Mm-hmm.
Which is, I think you can say until you're blue in the face, I want to hear the bad news, I won't shoot the messenger, and so on and so forth. But I think it's very rarely believed. And it's very rarely believed, not because we don't say it with passion and conviction, but because employees have had other experiences elsewhere, and they bring those other experiences to bear on it. So there's a point at which you have to make truth-telling a kind of public exercise before people will believe you.
Mm-hmm. Well, even if they haven't personally had
experience. I think I've always run very, very open companies where I was always open to anybody talking to me about anything. And yet I know for a fact that there were some things people didn't bring to me because they just thought, you know, either it'd be too uncomfortable or I wouldn't want to know or it would just be one more headache for me. And I think it's intensely difficult to create a culture in which people appreciate that information stops bad decisions.
Mm-hmm. So... how does this relate to that concept that you're talking about in your new book, the willful blindness? Is it connected?
Well, one of the arguments in willful blindness is that, you know, most bad business decisions, most bad business accidents and calamities, and indeed many sort of social and political calamities occur not because we couldn't see them coming, but because the information wasn't surfaced, or when it was surfaced, it was ignored. And so it deals in some detail, looking at the subject of organizational silence and why do people not speak up and what are the forces at work that stop them from speaking up. Because very, very rarely is a business failure an absolute surprise. When you go back and really untangle what happened, everybody knew months, if not years ahead, that that they were heading for the rocks. And so the book is really concerned with how can we stop ourselves being so blind? How can we see better? And it and a very big part of that premise is we have, among other things, we have to be each other's eyes. You know, we need a very wide range of perspectives from a very, very wide range of people. And if we don't have that, then we definitely will be blind.
Good. And on that note, we're almost out of time. It's gone so fast. Margaret, how can people reach you, find your book, et cetera?
Well, you can find my new book, Willful Blindness, on any of the Amazon sites in the U.S., the U.K., and Canada. And you can find vast numbers of blogs and all sorts of other information on my website, which is just www.mheffernan.com.
Good, good. And I also have your book up on the show page for the show. So if people are going to it, they can find it there too. Wonderful. Well, thank you so much.
I can't believe it.
It's a big pleasure. It's gone by so fast. Take care.
Thank you very much, Lisa.
You're welcome. Bye.
Bye.
Thank you for joining us tonight on the Leadership Focus, the show which gives you new ideas, interesting guests, and actionable strategies to help you be an incredible leader, a more balanced life. We hope that you've enjoyed the show. If you have, please go to blogtalkradio.com and become a friend and make us a favorite. To sign up for our free newsletter with more tips and strategies you can use, go to focuscoaching.net on the web. That's focuscoaching.net on the web. Until next time, this is your host, Lisa Pasbjorg, urging you to be a better leader every day.